Like Chief Revenue Officer, Chief Customer Officer is a relatively new role emerging in the technology industry. So what the heck does the Chief Customer Officer do? I am Thomas Law, the Executive Director of the Technology and Services Industry Association, and welcome to Tectonic, the podcast where we explore what makes technology business models successful in today's world. And today, I will be having a conversation with Mari Cross, the Chief Customer Officer at Infor. 2 years ago, I interviewed Mari about the differences between establishing customer success in a large legacy company versus growing customer success in a small, fast-growing startup. Today, we will be exploring the challenges facing the customer chief customer role in today's rapidly changing environment. So let's get the insight engine humming here. Welcome, Mari. It's great to have you on Tectonic. It's great to see you again. And let's start with the role of chief customer officer. That means a lot of things to a lot of people. Right? Who knows what's tucked in there? So can you overview your responsibilities in that role at Infor?
Sure. So I think in a very straightforward way, from a structure perspective, the chief customer officer at Infor leads everything that is post-sale, other than services. Infor is a global ERP provider, so services is a pretty big business. So that's a separate team, but otherwise customer success management, managed services, support, education, operations, our transformation functions and digital, all of that falls under the CCO. And the way we really think about it here is that we are the stewards of the customer journey and the voice of the customer. And so I and my team are often able to champion change, even if it's in other parts of the journey that are upstream, which is amazing, be it how we go to market or how we sell or how we even organize internally. And I think actually the CCO role here is really ideal. I love it here because it's what it should be in my mind. It's on the executive leadership team, truly has a seat at the table. And that speaks to the fact that Infor really has a strategy and a vision of, you know, the phrase that we succeed only when our customers succeed. So it plays out really well here.
So, and let me just get some clarification there. So when you talk about services, so things like the implementation, let's say professional services, consulting, that's different.
That's right. Yep.
Yep. And then what about the traditional technical support? What if there's a technical, is that
within? Technical support does roll under the CCO function here.
Okay. So it truly is, I mean, and this is really, I think, good for the audience to understand, the sort of clean line of demarcation is once the customer is on the platform, any of those touch points, customer success, technical support, blah, 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 managed, you know, service motions, those are going to be part of the chief customer officer.
Correct.
Makes sense. So I believe Infor does not have a CRO. So where does the responsibility for sales live? And tell me a little bit about that interaction between your organization and the sales organization.
At Infor, sales leadership is in fact divided between two sales leaders. Okay. There's a leader in international and then also one in the Americas.
Okay.
And we're very closely aligned with them. Mm-hmm. In fact, all of the functions under my customer organization have mappings to an Americas leader and an international leader. So we really do try to work very closely with our sales counterparts to make sure that that is a consistent experience for our customers. And of course, you know, alongside sales, we've got, you know, sales ops and marketing playing a crucial role as well in that sales process.
Yeah. So this is really interesting to me because this is very common where sales organizations typically align on a geographic basis. That's the most predominant way to organize a technology sales organization. But services, obviously you have regional, you know, resources, but you typically have sort of a global centric area. You say, hey, we are global support, global customer success. And so sometimes aligning those two things is a little clunky, right? Because you say, well, sales says, I don't think globally, I've got Americas and I've got this other region. And we kind of roll differently. And then you have to adjust to that because you say, well, look, we're customer success and we roll the same way no matter what region we're in. So how do you sort of deal with that rationalization?
Yeah. So, you know, it's actually interesting. We do have a global view both for the sales organization and the CS organization and even our services organization. But I think we do it also through a lens of there's a common foundation, but then inherently when you get global and you get to international regions, you just have to think slightly differently. You have to be region first and then maybe industry or, you know, the language really matters and so does the culture. Sure. And so we think about it as there's a foundational baseline. The program is the same for customer success, for instance, whether you're in the Americas or you're in international, but the way we think about staffing models, what expertise takes first seat, I guess, in the hiring profile, sometimes that is a little bit different.
Yeah. And I think, like you said, having a common program, I mean, one thought there is, you know, when you have a really well established, let's say, customer engagement lifecycle that both sales and services lives by, and you say, hey, this is the customer engagement lifecycle, and I don't care what region it is in, whatever, and everybody's educated and understands that. And then what you just said, which is important, and then you're going to have nuances based on the region, and there, that always happens.
Yeah. That's
and
right.
So the maturity,
right.
The size.
And the regions are in different levels of maturity as well, right?
Right, exactly.
So you have to think about it that way. And what I will say is we did actually go through a level of effort a couple of years ago to define a very distinct internally facing customer journey to make sure that we would organize ourselves consistently.
Yeah.
So there are key moments that matter, be it transition points or going live, for instance, going from our delivery organization to our, you know, post go live organization, or even from the sales organization to the delivery organization. It doesn't really matter what region you're in. Those things have to really be structured and highly operationalized in order to work well, because you can't have that be a free-for-all. It's too important.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I think common global processes, I think, are so critical. And really for the customer experience, and you know, you think about, you know, I'm sure you have global customers who have footprint in multiple regions, and you don't want them having a different experience. Like, oh, I had this kind of experience in this country and this other country was, you know, CS was very different or sales. And so, you know, having those common processes and people committed to them, I think is huge. But, you know, one of the reasons I wanted to have you on specifically is, you know, Infor is such an interesting case study because they've been around since 2002. So definitely, you know, you could say by definition, a legacy software company. And now you are competing in both an as a service world where, you know, everything's moved to, you know, SaaS, and then you also have this emerging AI world. So, hey, I'm a software company. What's my AI story? So let's start with that as a service, right? Where is the company navigating that transformation from, you know, I said on-prem software, customers are probably disconnected. Now I have them in as a service posture. I'm getting more connected. I'm moving them to the cloud. Give us an update on that.
Yeah. So Infor, it's been probably like three or four different companies along the way in terms of the focus areas. So a long time ago, we did have a period of rapid acquisition. So probably 150 companies were acquired.
How long ago was that?
Probably about, you know, 10, 15 years ago. Okay, there's quite a few people that work at Infor that hit their 30-year anniversary even.
Yeah.
Used to call different companies before Infor. So there's a lot of acquisitions in the history, very much so an on-prem mentality. But about 6 or 7 years ago, they made a really strategic bet that they wanted to go and do multi-tenant ERP, really wanted to go to the cloud. Yeah. And they didn't just hook things together and hope they worked. I mean, they really rebuilt the platforms from scratch. Mm-hmm. And so it's actually even now really interesting because there are some customers that are truly on-prem, but we have a very modern, very robust multi-tenant SaaS solution that is really the future, I would say, of where we're going and helping our customers that are on-prem kind of migrate to that cloud solution and then going in the market, really only selling our cloud solutions unless absolutely required. Yeah. So it has been definitely a little bit of a tale of multiple stages.
So on that posture, right, where, you know, because I've talked to a lot of legacy, you know, software companies where they have the old and they have the new, they have both in play. Very few companies, and you were at Adobe, you know, very few companies can do what Adobe did, which is burn the boats and say, look, we're just going to the new and we're going to just get everybody, push everybody to the new in 3 years. You know, people talk about that case study all the time, but it is really the minority case study, right? Because you cannot just push everybody over, but you do want to eat through that install base and get them to the new, right? And so I'll test something. My guess is you probably, for any net new logo opportunity, obviously you're just selling new, right? You're not going to sell the old legacy. Click into a little bit more about how you're working with your legacy customers and how you determine or incent them that, hey, now it's time to move. Because, you know, obviously you want to get them into the new.
Right. And I think because of the rich tapestry of customers that we have, I think we think about them in a couple of different categories.
Yep.
One, for some, there's really no upgrade path. We don't have a modern solution for whatever they are currently running. And for them, we want to continue to serve them and be their partner over the long haul. And then there's some folks that are on-prem, but do have the ability to migrate to the cloud. And so we're working with them on the plan on how to get them there. Mm-hmm. And then some folks have already either migrated or implemented, or maybe they are going single tenant first and then kind of taking a step toward multi-tenant. I would say the reason it's important and so different than Adobe, though, is that it really is so dependent on the software and what the problem the software is trying to solve. Yeah. So when you think about ERP, and just foundational to these companies, it is a much harder problem to solve, to say, hey, I'm going to implement a completely, you know, new financial system. There's so much risk that usually comes also with a lot of digital transformation on the customer side as well. Yep. So I would say the big difference also between Adobe and Infor is that the mission criticality of the software that Infor has makes that a slower transition process. Yeah. Most
what's more cautious. Yeah. For sure. Companies have to be more cautious. And you said an important thing there in terms of how you're going through that migration. And we see this all the time. And that is, you have a customer, they're on-prem, a legacy solution. But like you said, we might not have in the new, we might not have the exact capabilities that they need. It was very custom. It could have been whatever. Maybe we discontinue something. But one move you can make, because customers do say, look, I do want to get out of managing all this stuff. I want to get out of having all this on-prem. So you could put them in a managed posture. And we see that all the time, where you just move them and say, look, we'll take it over. Basically, you'll be a tenant of one. And that's going to be part of your migration. And we'll do that. And then when you put people in that posture, do you feel you could run them there, I won't say indefinitely, but for a very long time? Or do you feel like that, hey, that's like a 3 to 5 year gap clicking before we get a multi-tenant? How do you kind of view that when you get customers into a managed posture like that?
Yeah, I would say, you know, we've actually evolved in our thinking a little bit on that as well, which is, you know, the managed posture, it is good. You get them a step forward, but it's still quite a bit of work to go to the cloud, even from a managed posture.
Yeah, absolutely.
So they're highly customized solutions.
That's right. So yeah, exactly.
We have a really interesting platform that we built as well. So we've got our cloud suites, which are the ERP industry solutions. We have three of them. We also have this underlying platform called InforOS. It's our industry platform. What we have found really works even better is to get folks to adopt the platform in the cloud first, so they can have the on-prem core ERP still on-prem. Mm-hmm. Because our platform has things like a data lake and has APIs calling to data in. And so you can almost get the data out of the ERP into the platform, usable, kind of start getting a lot of the benefits of being in the cloud. And with that approach, you take a lot of the risk out of the equation for customers. So we've actually found that hybrid approach is actually...
I was about to say, it's the ultimate hybrid approach, where it's like, hey, part of my you know, capability is still on-prem, but now I'm leveraging capability, which is in the cloud. And that's a net new. So yeah, that's super interesting. You know, another question I want to ask you about this as a service transformation is the fact that you went through that in a public company like Adobe, and now you're going through it at Infor, which is not in the public eye. And so what differences are you experiencing there? Because, you know, we have members that are both, right? They're large public companies trying to do this. We have a lot of companies that were public, now they're under PE, they're trying to do this. So what are the big differences you see?
Yeah. Well, listen, I mean, I think just the reality is that a public company has quarterly pressures, and there's just no two ways about that. And in a market like this, it's probably even worse, right? Mm-hmm. So one of the key differences is really the level of flexibility that we have. And I would also say that we are very different than a private equity held company, right? So our ownership allows us, and the philosophy of our owners is very long-term economic thinking based. And so we are really encouraged to implement change and innovate and fail and invest, like not on an annual budget kind of cycle, but if we have a good idea, and even if that idea has a return in 3 years, there's usually money to be spent on the good idea and an appetite to let that play out. And that's a very liberating position. I've never experienced it before in my career. And so not having that quarterly pressure, plus having that flexibility to kind of swing for the fences and to think big and not to be limited by these artificial boxes of annual budgeting cycles, it's pretty fascinating.
Yeah. So I think an important nuance there, you're saying a traditional PE firm, you know, the audience I'm sure is well aware, but you know, their goal is if they make an investment 3 to 5 years, they're looking to move on from that or get another investor in. And so it is a relatively short fuse that you got to work under. What you're saying is you have a long-term, and there are companies that do this. They buy, you know, a company and say, look, we think this is a good solid business model. We think we can help optimize it, but we're not looking to spin this thing back out in 5 years. You know, we're happy to have it 10 years from now if it's a good, profitable revenue stream for us. So that definitely is different. You know, I have to tell you, Mario, I feel for any publicly traded software company that didn't basically kind of go through, you know, we call swallowing the fish, didn't go through the pain like 3-4 years ago when investors were pretty tolerant, like when Adobe went through it, investors were very tolerant of saying, look, you're going to go build recurring. We're super excited about recurring revenues. Okay, yeah. Profitability is going to go down. But, and again, money was cheap. And now, like you just said, it's tougher out there because investors are really, really looking at that bottom line and saying, look, you got to tell me a story about gross margin. You got to tell me a story about profitability. And I have a lot less appetite for you to tank there as you're going through this transformation. So I think some companies missed their window there. They should have, you know, taken the pain on, you know, when it was okay to do
when
that.
When it was easier to do that. Yeah. And I would say, like, right now, I mean, it's interesting. Like, I am building a customer success program during a time where everyone is, you know, cutting, you know, people. And I think, again, it doesn't mean that that's the only model. Like, we're also building a lot of scale in digital, but we are free to think about what is going to be the right model for our customers long-term to drive holistic success, taking into account, you know, retention that's going to happen in 5 years. Like, you know what I mean? Like, the view of what is the benefit of customer success, for instance, or support is seen in a much longer time scale.
Yeah.
And that matters how we're investing now today in those programs.
Yeah. You know, we do these 6-month research journeys. We pick topics that are super relevant to our members, sort of bleeding edge topic. Next 6 months, we're going to work really hard to get new research on the table, report out on that at our conferences. And so Stephen Fulkerson has a thread. He leads our CS practice. He has a thread going on right now around the value of CS. And it specifically is, what are the best practices for defending the value of your CS resources because of what you said, you know, a couple of minutes ago, which is, you know, you're in an environment where you're watching other technology companies really cut that back. And they're saying, well, gosh, we don't know what the value is for sure. We don't have a bit, you know, clear ROI here. We, you know, we think it's helping the business, but, you know, we can't connect the dots and we're under pressure for profitability. So that's a place to go after. And so it's really become, you know, 3 years ago, everyone was invest in CS. Then now it's like, hey, I'm cutting unless you give me a reason, a really compelling reason that I can't cut. So you really have to get your act together. If you have that function, that you can tell that story of what the value is.
And it's also, you know, it'll be really telling because I think, truth be told, again, I think we have so much innovation coming down the pike that it will get easier to service customers, like with, you know, Gen AI. And there's lots of things that are going to help us scale. But ultimately, it is also the kind of problem you can't unwind very quickly, right? So if you get rid of CS and you go down that path, you do find yourself in a situation that will then take a couple of years to fix potentially.
Yeah, you can have some massive self-inflicted wounds right now. If you just cut because you just say, hey, everybody just take, you know, you know how cuts go. You know, sometimes it's like, look, we need to be more profitable. So everybody across the board takes a 10% haircut or 15% haircut or 20%, you know, pick a number, right? And I think that when you do that in a very blunt way, maybe you can get away with that for your first 5 or 10. Everybody has a little, you know, some things you can trim. But then when you start to cut in the muscle, you know, that's right. Not equal. Some muscle is going to impact you worse in a year from now, 2 years from now. And so again, you can be a very much a self-inflicted wound. But you just made a comment about, you know, we do think that there are going to be some new capabilities on the table that help us deliver things like customer success more cost effectively. So I want to turn to AI. And specifically, you know, let's start with the customer-facing capabilities. What are you exploring there for, you know, for your CS and support, et cetera, on the AI side?
Well, so I would say, like, from a product perspective, we've had machine learning and AI as a core component of our products and solutions for a while, but Gen AI is certainly, you know, that's an even bigger unlock.
Yeah.
We launched a lot of Gen AI-powered capabilities within our solutions in April. We have more coming out in October. And what I will say is that what I'm observing is that it's not just Gen AI per se, it's the combination of these wonderful innovations like even regular machine learning, automation, Gen AI. You stitch them all together and you can have these incredibly robust and powerful solutions for customers where rather than needing even to have an experience where you have to learn how to use a software, it just gets automated away for you, right? Yeah. The workflow that you would have to do. So just a couple of examples, for instance, we have industry-specific data within our solutions and lots of processes. We're feeding them into these large language model. And what we're, for instance, for warehouse management, you know, at this point now we can just say, hey, compare how these three warehouses are doing, give me the pros and cons of each so we can, you know, swap learnings like that easily.
Yep.
Or complex project management where these ERPs have lots of different projects that are there managing. Now we can just easily ask the you know, our Gen AI interaction to say, please give me the top five risks with this project. So we can immediately get to the insight and then start spending time solving for the risk versus doing the analysis to try to even identify what's going on. So I think those are just, you know, we have, and of course, like there's a lot of automation around content creation within the description generation, internal bot, conversational engines, things like that as well.
Yeah. I mean, we as listeners to this podcast know, and if people are following our research, I mean, we are incredibly bullish on the applications of AI and the use cases that are already real. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned education services, content creation, very mature. The project management risk, you know, we just did a case study with Salesforce, the Shally, who I think you know, she leads their global delivery. That's one of the use cases that they're saying, hey, we can do the risk management on this. So there's just use case after use case, and the impacts are incredible. But you said something that really caught my ear about some of these workflows, you know, where we had to basically insert people, are going to become just automated. They will. And JB Wood, who's our CEO, he was road testing this concept with me just yesterday. He's working on his keynote already for Envision in the fall, which I get working with JB. I can tell you that this is incredibly not the norm. He never works this far ahead on content, but he's really, him and I, because we keep, you know, we have this laser focused on the impact of AI on our business models. And he said to me, he said, you know, hear this out. He threw me a couple slides. And he said, I think the concept for tech companies, B2B, is going to be a digital first customer engagement model. Mm-hmm. And he said, you know, the way he framed it, he said, look, the way we have thought about that customer engagement lifecycle, everything from selling to implementation to is that it was, we had people first supported by some technology, and we're going to reverse our thinking. It's going to be technology first and then people, you know, leveraging that. And so I think it's going to fundamentally change the customer experience, and I think in a good way. And I'm curious what your thoughts of that evolution.
Well, and I agree. I mean, I think, first of all, you have to go where customers want to be. And I think right now, really people do want information fast. And I think this is all tied, by the way, also like to other trends, which is if we go further into consumption-driven operating models or usage-based pricing and things like that, that all plays into this idea that you start within a product, you're interacting digitally, and you grow over time, right? Yep. So it does make a lot of sense to me, especially on a couple of different facets there. I do think it will also, though, differ based on product. Like I said, you know, living in the ERP world, it's very hard to imagine a company going completely digital first in ERP implementation just because it's too foundational to their experience. But I think as a general statement, I would actually very much so agree with you.
Yeah, I think it's going to be interesting to watch. And I agree with you. I mean, there is different levels of complexity out there that we're all dealing with as enterprise solution providers. But I'll make a bet with you here, right? So I think most enterprise companies, when they think about that spectrum of complexity and they say, okay, yeah, B2C technology companies, yeah, their use cases are simple. Of course, they can be very digital first, whatever, but that's B2C. I'm way different. I'm way more complex in every step of the way. My sales motions are super complex. My implementation is super complex. My technical support is super complex. And so if you think about that complexity, right, from low to high, I think a lot of tech companies are still thinking, yeah, the very low end stuff will be digital first, but definitely not, you know, the medium and never the high. And I think that the digital first approach is going to eat through more of it than any of us realize right now. And I agree, there's still going to be some complexity that's on the table that never gets eaten through. That's fine. But I think that people are underestimating how far the technology will be able to take them and how much customers will lean into it. I was doing a podcast with David Judge, who runs customer success for Azure, you know, the Azure offer at Microsoft. And, you know, they've AI enabled their customer portal. And by giving that new capability to customers, their self-service rate went up by like 32%.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Because customers are happy to do it. If you get, like you just said, if you give them the answer right away and they don't have to go struggle for it, they'd rather do that than have to get in the queue or wait for somebody to email them back.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, and I think also I very much believe also that we should be thinking through the more complex use cases for digital engagement versus the simplest ones. I actually really believe in that.
Yeah.
When you think about creating flows from even, you know, the value selling to capability someone can get to creating automated adoption roadmap, you know what I mean? Like you can pull those threads and very, like some really hard thinking through digital and technology all the way. And then that becomes very valuable. We're testing AI-enabled things, you know, certainly for our support teams, for education, you know, marketing, contract summarization. I mean, we have all these experiments going on. What I have found that's also really fascinating, though, maybe I'm aging myself a little bit here, but it's almost reminds me of like the good old process improvement days, though, because you know, when you think about this wonderful technology, it also does make you think about the process that teams have to go through and really documenting and understanding it. And just that alone drives so much efficiency is what I've also noticed, right? So it's like the automation of it is the second part. The first part is even people starting to pay attention to what those processes are for customers or for ourselves.
Big time. I mean, and to build on what you just said there. So one of the things we've learned by looking at successful case studies, deployments of AI, is where people have success is where they have a well-understood workflow, which is what you just said. And they say, okay, and it could be content creation. It could be how I deal with the support ticket. And I see where I could apply AI to add value to either to automate or to augment my current staff. And I can apply it and I can see the KPIs move, right? The productivity. The use cases that aren't working is when you don't really understand the workflow. And you say, I don't know, I'm going to throw like, you know, Copilot out there and see if that helps. Yeah. I'm going to, you know, so to your point, you know, the first step is to really understand and inspect, which by the way, I think one of the reasons that both customer success and professional services are lagging behind support and education on AI adoption is that support and education, they typically have some pretty well-defined workflows. And CS can be a little bit more mushy, as you know, in a lot of companies. And, and PS is often like a brain on a stick model, I refer to it, right? And so it's harder for them to get the ROI right away because they have to get their proverbial process house in order. You know, so I think you're spot on with that. It's really, it's interesting. Another thing around AI, I wanted to ask you about this because I was looking on the Infor website and I see that you have these specific vertical solutions that are listed. And I'm seeing AI being a capability that helps verticalize. I'm just curious, what tactics are you employing as the chief customer officer to say, look, how do we better serve specific vertical industries so we can really be in tune with their needs? How do you, you know, approach that?
Yeah, I mean, I would say being industry focused is, again, that's like part of our strategy and vision. And so we very much so hire and enable for that expertise, you know, through people for sure. We also do quite a bit to try to drive insight and a common language around vertical industries. And I would say we're not even just verticalized. We focus down to the sub-vertical levels, so like really understanding the micro vertical. So if you think about, you know, we've got a discrete manufacturing. Well, the way, let's say, a dairy works versus a butcher is actually quite different. And like, they've got really different concerns about, you know, how you slice the meat is a, is a concern that a butcher would have. And that doesn't matter to dairy. So like, we really go very, very deep in understanding that. But I think our biggest approach is to put that into the product itself so that we can kind of build in the top 5-10 use cases, right? Like it comes pre-configured for ease of implementation at a micro level so that you're ending up customizing only maybe the last 20% of it versus the entire thing. And that minimizes risk, that minimizes certainly cost, and it makes it much more predictable, which are all basically reasons ERP implementations typically don't
fail.
When you over customize things.
So I will tell you that what you're saying does absolutely terrifies a majority of technology executives, right? Because when you talk about this issue of verticalization, and I've had this conversation with, you know, biggest, you know, software hardware companies in the world, and they go, oh my gosh, that's like the last thing we want to do, especially at the product level, because it's just like so much cost and blah, blah, blah. But we have actually argued for years. It's like, look, that's where the margin is going to be. If you don't verticalize, you are going to be commoditized plumbing. And so just put a little bit more, you know, meat on the bone here in terms of that life cycle, because you said, hey, we want to understand the difference between a butcher and a dairy farmer. That journey, and you mentioned people earlier, like having people from the industry, how do you start that journey to say, look, we don't understand dairy farmers. We've got to understand their use cases, their, you know, what they care about. Then we've got to get that knowledge into the product. Just roughly, how do you go about that?
Really strategically, we focus on just 7 main areas of focus, you know, a couple of years ago, and we are sticking to it. So I would say we're not trying to change that all the time. And we're really, we are, we know we can't boil the ocean. So we picked.
So you pick your areas for sure on the vertical.
Where we can be competitively advantaged. And we've really focused on those. And the more we work with our customers, the more we learn and the more we build into our products, right? So it is really one of those things that once you start on that journey, it really, it's like that gap between others kind of continues. Mm-hmm. And also, if you think about it, if someone is highly customized, you know, the whole point of being in a multi-tenant cloud environment is so you can take advantage of innovation that comes out every quarter or 6 months or whatever it is. And if you're highly customized, you can't take advantage of that.
Totally agree.
Right. So it is also a future proofing for us that we really believe in. And it is probably a little bit more expensive to build out at first. But I think over the long term, to your point, it is actually going to be cheaper for customers. It will drive more ROI for them and for us. And that's also why we built the platform, because we decided to take a lot of the common services elements, be it security, right? Or, you know, again, the data lake, things like AI, Gen AI. I mean, these are all things that are offered in our platform. So we really only go deep on the things that we really need to in the actual core ERPs that are differentiated.
Yeah. And if I play that back, I mean, I think about this spectrum, right? And on one end, and there are software companies, you know, that this has been their business model. Yeah. Every customer is bespoke in a Snowflake, and they are happy to customize the heck out of their solution, because they're like, we're going to be so sticky, you will never, ever be able to tear us out, right? And so there are, you know, software companies that have made a lot of money that way. That's one model. The other end of the spectrum is to say, look, really, it's one size fits all, right? Mm-hmm. I have a horizontal solution. Maybe my partners can help customize or whatever. That's not what we do. Here it is. I'm about scale, right? And so those are the two extremes. And, you know, I think the bespoke model for the customer is just the wrong way for a lot of different reasons. I think a lot of customers are like, I'm kind of done with that. So I think that is really getting a lot long in the tooth for sure. But I also think on the other end that this blunt instrument of a horizontal model is under pressure. So what you describe is you guys are literally trying to be in the middle of that spectrum and say, we're going to pick, you know, the markets we care about, but we are going to really understand those markets. There is going to be some level of customization in the product to support those, but it's not going to be bespoke. It's not going to be crazy at every customer. We're looking for pattern recognition here. If we really understand the patterns, that's our differentiator. And it's going to allow us to do this in a way where we still can make money, but we can serve that particular market better than just a blunt generic solution.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of our customer success motions is actually retiring customization, right? So we try to work with our customers that even if they did customize a while back, but we now release functionality that is going to be more in the product. Like, we really want to work with our customers to be like, okay, we did it this way because we had to before. How do we get you into the standard as much as possible? Yeah. Because now we have something available to you. And again, our goal is to future-proof our customers and have them be, you know, we want to be able to drive competitive advantage for them to make them be as agile and nimble as possible. So
I've been in this arm wrestling match with different people in terms of the customization, right? Mm-hmm. And one of the pushbacks that I hear, because I really do believe that customers have incredibly custom, complex environments, that they are starved for help on that. Help me with this complexity, smooth out. So tell me this conversation when you're talking to a customer and you're saying, look, you have a super crazy process here. You know, we're supporting your software. It's overly complicated. Let us help you. Let's get rid of that. Let's get you in best practices. Let's get you, like you said, let's future-proof you. Are you finding they're more receptive to that now than they might have been, you know, 5 years ago? Or is that still like, because a lot of customers are really wedded. Like, I'm super special. I'm very, very unique, Mari. I mean, we have to be custom. So what do you see in there?
I think everyone has their own special sauce, right? And so we are happy to customize your special sauce. If you have something that's really unique, you've figured out an interesting way of doing something.
Yeah.
Let's do that, right? And then we do have to work with customers to make sure they understand that by going standard, there's most likely going to be a change management effort on their part, because that's really where it usually you know, breaks down.
Yep.
I think the reason it's a little bit easier now, and this is why I think automation and AI help, is that we now have a few more levers, whereas before it was like, we actually have to change the process your teams go through. And now we're saying, well, actually, we can just automate the process away. It's not change. It's just going to be gone.
Yeah, we just got rid of that complexity. Yeah.
So that's one, I think, lever.
Interesting.
The other is our solution is also trying to build a complete suite. So it's not necessarily that any one of the components in our platform is the best of breed. So like, we've got a data lake, but it's not Snowflake, but it is very robust. And it's built on AWS technology. So like, it's very robust. We also have a process intelligence tool that we're launching in October, right? And so imagine this, we have the power actually to map a customer's processes, like in a process modeler, but it's all native into the solution. And then we can say, you folks compared to others that run these processes, when you show them how much slower they are, or, you know what I mean? Like the
super powerful.
Super powerful. So you know, people might say they don't want to change, but when you kind of see those variations, you're like, oh.
Yeah. I mean, I love that framing and that approach with customers, because you mentioned secret sauce. And I agree with you. Every company should have some nature of that. But what is that? Is that a 90-10 rule, 80-20? Your secret sauce is not 30, 40, 60% of your processes, but probably 30, 40, 60% of your processes, literally you're running suboptimal to what the best practice is in the industry. And so really helping a customer separate that out and saying, okay, here's stuff that everyone else is doing better than you. Clearly, A, it's not secret sauce by definition because you're worse at it, and we can get you to a best practice. And then whatever's left over here that really is special, that's fine. We can support that. But I think that's such a helpful conversation for customers. And I think they're starved for it. I really think they're starved for it.
I will say that the biggest challenge is that in this market, and certainly in our industry, the big transformation we're making is that we have to get even bolder and bolder, right? So mm-hmm. I think we passionately believe in this, but we have to make sure that our teams are giving that advice to customers. Yep. And because there is a little bit of that historical orientation to saying, what would you like, right? Yep. Versus, let us show you a better way and let's have a discussion on that, right?
Yeah. So several years ago, we did a paper on what we call the supplier-led sales model as opposed to a customer-led sales model. So customer-led mm-hmm. sales model, but the customer gives you the RFP. They say, well, here's my top issue. You know, here's the thing you have to, here's my process. You know, make your software adhere to it. The supplier-led sales model is exactly what you just articulated, which is you're being bolder and you're coming to the table and you're saying, well, we deal with hundreds of people like you. You're an N of one. Yeah. We're dealing with the TSI business model. We're looking at lots of companies. You're an N of one. So, you know, we know what this good ERP process looks like. Let us help you get to best here. And like, so let's help future-proof you. Let's make sure you can take advantage of the latest and greatest technology capabilities. And I think that that is just such a, you know, more effective way for the, you know, for the customer to have this technology unfolded to them.
Yeah. And for a lot of these customers, if you think about it, especially with ERP, like they're not doing this every year or two,
no,
right?
This is foundational for them.
A decade can go by. And so, I mean, talk about highly, you know, risk fraught, nerve-wracking, you know, software purchase.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's like super mission critical and you don't do it very often. And so the idea that you would have a partner that says, hey, we know what good looks like. We're going to guide you through this process. We're going to let you keep your secret sauce, but you know, let's do this together. I think it is really powerful.
Well, and so that framing about, hey, you're in a space where people do this maybe once in a decade. I think what's really cool, if we think about, you know, positive for the industry right now, is if you were doing an ERP system 10 years ago, there was going to be a lot of customization. It was going to be months and months of implementation, integration. You get done, you're like, God, I think I got the ROI here. I mean, it's just, it was complex, messy, expensive. If you are going to hit the refresh button right now on something like an ERP or any of your big foundational software systems, right? You should be coming out the other end where you have probably, like you keep saying, taking some of these processes completely off the table. They're automated. They just happen for you. You're going to have a whole new set of technical capabilities through generative AI, you know, other types of AI, machine learning that are now giving you insights and capabilities you never had before. You should be in a posture where it's way easier to make changes to that environment moving forward. You should be in a posture where it's cloud more scalable. You can go up and down. So it's just going to be completely night and day in terms of what you can get if you hit the refresh button compared to 10 years ago. And I think that sometimes we're in the middle of it, we get lost with how much it's changing for the better. But I think it's an exciting time for customers that do have to cross that bridge right now. I think they're in a better place than they would have been even 5 years ago in terms of what they can get for their money.
100%. 100%. Yeah. The innovation right now is super exciting. It's real time. I mean, there's a lot. It's like things are coming together in a really interesting way.
I've never seen things move this fast. You know, I lived through the internet like you did. And I thought that was going to be like the biggest impact technology I'd seen in my career. And I was wrong. I mean, this is moving a lot faster. Well, I'm going to end here with, I'm watching the clock with the futures. Yeah. So, you know, we've been chipping on this a little bit, but what do you think is going to be incredibly different about software business models if we just go off 5 years from now? Because again, we got a lot of innovation going on right now.
Yeah, I think, you know, we did talk about this a little bit. I think this idea of user experience is going to be completely redefined, right? So, you know, instead of driving adoption in a traditional sense and enablement in a traditional sense, I mean, that whole construct is, you know, all around you're going to automate things away. You're going to engage with voice that you don't have to learn to use a system. You're going to be able to just ask your question to the system. I mean, it's going to be, I think, a really, really interesting concept there. And when you add to it things like low code or no code, that also allows people to really change their own user experience potentially to how they want it. So versus getting things customized or even enhancement requests, this idea of enhancement requests.
Yep.
Like I think there's gonna be just a lot more power in the hands of the actual users, which I, and you know, certainly a lot of self-serve. So I think that's gonna be really, really interesting. Clearly huge amounts of data and analytical capabilities. I think it's gonna unlock personalization at this crazy level. Mm-hmm. I think the flip side, have some data privacy and security issues, I'm sure. And then honestly, like if it really, you know, we're talking about consumption driven models already as well. I think that I believe is going to happen. For me though, I will say that I've seen a little bit of Confluent when I was there. We started playing around with it, Adobe. We're talking about it here at Infor. I mean, I do get a little bit nervous when I hear about it as being touted just like as a pricing model or something like that. That's a complete company transformation.
Oh, absolutely.
So I think
that
is an end-to-end transformation of how everyone shows up to work every day. So I think that'll be really the one to watch.
Yeah, I was reading a letter from a CEO to investors. It was like, I can't remember the software company, but they decided, this is about 4 years ago, they decided to go from traditional, you know, user-based pricing to consumption-based. And he explained into this letter to the investors that this is what you just said. This is not a pricing change. This is a complete business model change, soup to nuts. It impacts everybody. How we service the customer, how we sell the customer, how, you know, our account, everything. And just that one future thread on pricing models, I'll just pick that one up. You know, usage-based, consumption-based pricing has been a thought. We wrote a book called Consumption Economics over a decade ago and saying, look, that's a natural progression for how customers are going to want to buy tech. And obviously the big cloud folks like AWS and Google, you know, are in that type of model. But now for the first time in history, I am seeing all the enterprise software companies getting serious about this. And the underlying pressure is they're realizing, and this is kind of related to AI, you know, a lot of their customers are flatlining some of their hiring or declining. And they're saying, hey, I'm coming up with renewals and there's no natural growth if it's user-based, because guess what? There's less users from the year before, but the company grew, my customer grew, but there's less users.
Well, again, going back to this idea of when you automate processes away, right? You need fewer people. That's the, I mean,
a seat just went away.
Yeah, that's why we are thinking about consumption-driven
absolutely.
You know, models, because like you're still using the system probably in a pretty significant way to automate those
and
processes.
And getting value, tons of value.
Tons of value, but we're not charging for it. So like, yeah, we will, given our strategy, have to really address it.
Yeah, and again, I think every enterprise software company out there on user-based pricing is going to be, that is going to be the conundrum that's going to force them to say, I got, and this is going to be crazy because how many decades and decades and decades have we been on this pricing model? Right.
Oh, yeah. And it's everything from, you know, the financials and forecasting and revenue recognition, role definition, to your point, right? Like, everything. So what does a CS person do versus a seller do in a consumption driven model, right? Like, when does the sale really end? Is there a seller?
Exactly.
Anymore, right. I mean,
what is renewal? Does renewal even mean anything? If it's all usage based, what are they renewing? So, it's a new world. Well, hey, I really appreciate you stopping in today. It's a great conversation, as always. And I always end these episodes with a question of the day. And if you are a software executive out there, the question I have for you, are you ready for this next generation of software business models? Cheers, everybody.